Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of Horror Weekly, the most underrated horror villain of all time. We asked 500,000 horror fans online who the most underappreciated horror baddie was, and we're here with their answers and ours. I think you're in for a few surprises here. We got a horror villain played by the movie's director himself. We've got a horror villain who wore one of the most iconic masks in scary cinema, but only got to appear in one film. We've got a terrifying monster played by a beloved sitcom comedy favorite. We got a villain named after a type of wood. We've got a movie coming up that's going to shed some, I think, new light on why John Carpenter's The Thing is so amazing, even though the movie is not The Thing. And we've got a creature of the night from what I'm told is a very divisive horror movie, but it's not in our community. Every time we've talked about it on the Horror Weekly pages, I'd say it's 90-10 love-hate, with the vast majority going into love. So this might be a divisive movie, but not for us. So join us as we face our fears and discover the most underrated horror villain of all time. So let's dive into the community's answers first. There's basically two categories here. The group of movies or villains that I wouldn't have put in my own list because I wouldn't necessarily have considered them underrated, and then the ones that were. And there were no rules when we posted this question. It was just said, name your favorite or the best underrated horror villain of all time. So who's to say, right? But by far and away, the winners in the community answers were the tall man from Phantasm, who I don't consider underrated, I guess. I mean, the movie generated so many sequels that Angus Grimm is so well known in the horror community, graced the pages, the covers of Fangoria, etc. But it's definitely a villain that has less visibility than like a Jason or a Michael. So I can see where that's coming from. I just wouldn't have put it in my list. There was also Billy from Black Christmas, which is really interesting because a lot of the things that are going on our Horror Weekly list are going to be there for pretty special reasons. Like, we wanted to pick things that accomplish something very few other movies did for some reason or another. And Billy is like that in the sense that we don't really know what he looks like, except for that very creepy eye, at least in the original version. And we don't really know motivations. So refreshing lack of backstory. But again, Black Christmas is such a highly regarded film. It was the winner in a poll we did of best standalone slasher movies that weren't in franchises. So definitely appreciated. Again, I can see why it came up in the voting, but not something that would have been on my list. There was also Harry Warden, My Bloody Valentine. Again, wouldn't have been on my list, but I can see it. I mean, that's a pretty well-known horror movie. I think Quentin Tarantino said it's his favorite slasher movie of all time, oddly. There's Sam from Trick or Treat, which is an amazing answer, but I think also, again, very well known and appreciated. I just love that Sam gets a full-on duel with Brian Cox, who is amazing all the time and has now found new fame with Succession, although he played an amazing Hannibal Lecter in Manhunter. And the last winner of the community voting that I wouldn't put on my own underrated list was Pumpkinhead. Again, because of the sort of well-known and appreciated and sequels. Now, here's the winners of the voting that did make my list. So first of all, David Cronenberg as Dr. Decker in Nightbreed. And we're going to have a few characters here that have like things in front of their names, like doctor or lord, and this is the first one off the jump. There's something so chilling about the obvious joy that Dr. Decker has in killing people and the affectless way that David Cronenberg basically plays the character. He's almost playing the character with no emotions, but you're still picking up all the emotions, and it's such a weird effect. Plus, just the look of that character, right? Come on, in the mask. One of my favorite horror villain visuals of all time. And the purposeful, unstoppable way he moves, it's very hard to sell that as, like, basically a human character, like a non-supernatural force, but moving with supernatural precision and power. It's like his mind is an evil engine that just makes his body go. Next, we have Dr. Carl Hill from Reanimator. Played by the remarkable David Gale, this villain gets in on facial expressions alone and zest for evil and just sheer energy. I find this one interesting because Herbert West, the character played by the legendary Jeffrey Combs, also got some votes for the villain role, but Dr. Hill got way more votes, came out near the top. But I thought it was really cool that there were multiple villains in this and that there was villain-on-villain crime, which is going to happen in my number one choice later on. Next, near the top, we have Lord Summerisle, played by Christopher Lee in The Wicker Man. Lee doesn't get that much screen time in this movie, but as usual, he makes the absolute most of it. He cared and loved this about this movie so much that I think he waived his entire fee and did it for free. And you can tell in his performance, just absolutely bone-chilling. And last for the community voting, we have Frank Zito from Maniac, which is interesting because both versions got votes. The 1981 definitely got more, but it's really interesting to see two actors play the same character and get credible votes on either side. Very rare for the horror genre. All right, let's get into our picks. The first underrated horror movie villain chosen by us is the black spiky mold from the movie Splinter, 2008, starring Shea Whigham as Farrell, Jill Wagner as Polly, Paulo Costanzo as Seth, and directed by Toby Wilkins. If you haven't seen Splinter, my God, I recommend it. It's kind of a two-piece movie, starts as a hostage-taking road crime situation, and then turns into an insane combination of The Blob and The Thing. And there's a reason that those two movies are so beloved in the horror movie community. And this really taps into that. It's a very, very small cast. But basically, a wanted fugitive and his girlfriend end up trapped in a gas station with their two hostages. And not only are the police after them, but there's this black alien spiky mold that if it touches you, infects you, enslaves you, and then turns you into a kind of The Last of Us sort of zombie. So remember, we were looking for things that made these villains special on top of being underrated. I don't know a ton of people who have seen this movie, so that automatically moves it into my underrated category. But the special element here is that this is The Thing without the paranoia. And it kind of is going to shed, it's, at least to me, it shed light on another way that The Thing is an amazing movie that I didn't really catch at first, which is the recipe of The Thing, a creature that can, you know, eat you, mutate, copy you. When you die from this creature, you die absolutely horribly in the most ghastly way possible. That is part of the recipe of The Thing. But The other part of the recipe of the thing is the paranoia. Who is the thing? Who can you trust? So Splinter takes that evil infectiousness principle, but dispenses entirely with the paranoia. Believe me, when you get infected by the Splinter, everyone knows. At least if you get massively infected, there is a sneaky infection going on, and that'll actually more make the paranoia point in a second. And exactly like the thing, Splinter has a character that's kind of a scientist who figures out exactly what's happening, pretty much, just the way that the thing scientists were really on to what was happening pretty early into the film. Except for, I think the Splinter scientist is a better scientist, and he's not evil. I think he's a student, but I think he's a better scientist than all the thing scientists put together, because he clocks what the Splinter creature is doing. He figures out its feeding versus waste system, how it metabolizes. He identifies its weaknesses, which are the usual fire and cold in a way. But that still does them almost no good, because this is a killer creature. It chops people in half. It breaks their bones and ligaments from inside. It is gruesome as hell. It's relentless, and it also, kind of like the tentacle in the mist, can move on its own, although way more than the mist. This thing, even in pieces, can come after you and take you out. There's an amazing, like, part of the sequence of the movie where there's a forearm and a hand from an infected person chasing them around the gas station, and the effects are really good, and it's terrifying, because all it has to do is lodge just like one of these splinters in you and you're gone. But there's another special element that I don't think gets talked about quite enough into making a horror villain truly great, and that is showing the effect of the villain on the cast. The sleep deprivation and jumpiness and fear in the cast of Elm Street movies, what the idea of Freddy is doing to them, is a big part of what makes him great. And in Splinter, you have hostages and the hostage taker who couldn't be more far apart. And the acting in this is incredible. Shane Wingham playing Farrell, I love that his name basically means feral, right? It's remarkable how likable and scary he is at the same time. But these characters hate each other, don't trust each other, and betray each other at every turn. There's a moment early on in the movie where Farrell goes out to try to save his girlfriend, who has been splinterfied and has no chance. And as soon as he gets out the door, Polly locks the door immediately behind him and won't open it. And her boyfriend is arguing with her to open it. He's like, he's got a gun. He's just going to shoot through the glass. And she's not going to open it to let him in. So you have this divide between the three characters. None of them are on the same pages at all. But by the end of the movie, they're like a cohesive unit. They're like a band. They seem to all genuinely like each other by the end, definitely respect each other, and they've been driven into that situation by sheer terror. It would be like Donald Trump and Joe Biden going on a family vacation together and having a great time. Imagine the force that it would take to make that happen, because these characters start out in such antipathy to each other and end up so bonded. It really reflects back on how terrifying and seemingly unstoppable the villain of this movie is. And as for the lack of paranoia I mentioned earlier, mild spoilers, there's a moment where they discover that Farrell has been infected by the splinter. It hit him on his finger, and it's working its way up his arm. And the Polly and Seth don't even blink, really. They're not like, oh, we got to get away from him. We got to shoot him in the head. We got to throw him out of the building. They're like, no, they immediately go into problem solving mode. They're like, no, we're going to amputate your arm. We're going to stop this infection before it gets to you. And they do it. They pull it off with no experience in this. And Farrell joins them in the end fight, one armed at this point. So even when he was sort of hiding that he was infected, it led to no paranoia, no resentment at all. They just kind of dealt with the situation and moved on, which is the opposite of what happens in The Thing. And like I said, that's just a testament to the power of Carpenter's The Thing. When people were trying to rip off Carpenter's Halloween, they were trying to take everything. They were trying to take everything it did. They were trying to take the lurking background moves, the masked killer moves, the moody music, etc. Splinter only stole half of The Thing, and that's all it needed to be a great horror movie on its own. Now I'm going to blitz through a couple of my runner-up picks for most underrated, only because we've covered this pretty extensively on the podcast already, but they just can't be ignored. So Marlowe from 30 Days of Night, played by Danny Houston, Angelica Houston's half-brother, is one of the most underrated horror villains ever. Just absolutely chilling to the core. Unmatchable, really, modern vampire performance. The human bait scene that culminates in the incredible God looking up at the sky, looking down at the victim, no God moment, is one of the most memorable in recent horror history. And as I mentioned in the intro to the podcast, this is always, I see this a lot on lists of very divisive horror films, and I remember that it was, but I'm not sure it is anymore. This might be like a Halloween 3 effect where respect for it grew over time. And I don't know. I can't speak for the rest of the horror community that's outside of Horror Weekly, but I can tell you when we post about this movie, we get very little resistance. And I also feel like Mahogany, played by Vinnie Jones from The Midnight Meat Train, also deserves a mention here. But we actually mini reviewed this movie in our previous podcast episode called Best Standalone Slasher Films. So I don't want to go through all of it again, but this is one of the genuine scary villains. And I still don't think this movie or Vinnie Jones gets enough love. So Midnight Meat Train, also on the list. Now next is, I guess, a mini cheat, but whatever. It's Bad Cooper, played by the immortal Kyle MacLachlan, in the Twin Peaks The Return, the revival of Twin Peaks. Now, if you haven't seen Twin Peaks and you only know it by reputation, you're thinking like Black Coffee, Cherry Pie, Dancing Unicorns, whatever weirdness that you're thinking. But Bad Cooper, the evil version of Agent Dale Cooper, is a sneaky rival to Michael Myers, but with an intellect, with the ability to articulate kind of a philosophy of evil. Halloween is my deepest love as a horror franchise, and I would put Bad Cooper up against Michael Myers, even money, without blinking. Actually, I guess I should have said I would put him up against Jason, because Derek Mears, of playing Jason fame in 2009, is in Twin Peaks The Return. He faces Bad Cooper, and he gets his arm snapped off in an arm wrestling match. Think of what happens, what Jeff Goldblum does arm wrestling in The Fly, but worse. And then he gets his entire head caved in with a single punch from Evil Cooper. He effortlessly kills or dismantles so many characters throughout the run of Twin Peaks The Return that I lost count. And this is a character that might just not kill you. It might banish you to the Black Lodge or worse places where your soul will languish forever or 100 years or 1,000 years in pain and torture. His mantra is, I don't need, I want, which is chilling, like a distillation of I can't be stopped, and I'm doing it because I want to, not because like I have some tragic backstory or because I'm trying to get revenge or something. He just delights in cruelty. There's a great confrontation scene between the magnificent Laura Dern and Kyle MacLachlan as Bad Coop, which is, I got goosebumps. It was so scary and like whatever the reverse of touching is, it like drained the emotions out of the TV. Just almost an awful, sick feeling watching it. And that's not even the worst of him. I think the worst moment is he kills someone in after getting information out of them. They're in a seedy hotel room, and she asks kind of pitifully, just staring into his eyes, "Are you going to kill me now?" And he says, "Yes, yes, Daria, I am." Like, as flat a tone as Hal from 2001. Just a remarkable performance and character. All right, just two more runner-ups, and then we're at the main event, our choice for most underrated. So next we have Howard, played by John Goodman, in 10 Cloverfield Lane. This is a villain so scary, so intimidating, so awful that when you get away from him and you're facing a War of the Worlds alien, fumigate you to death, maybe digest you Nope style situation, you feel better. You'd rather be dealing with that than trapped in a closed in space with friggin' John Goodman in this movie. Again, like with Splinter, a very small cast. And I love when movies can do this and still feel big in scale and make it work and not be boring without like a whole bunch of characters to distract you. The thing that makes this special is how human it is. Unlike a lot of the other choices that were voted on by both us and the community or chosen by, this is someone that you might meet in real life. And it's terrifying, first of all, how off he plays this character, where you just can't quite get a read on what went so horribly wrong inside of him. And also his sheer unpredictability because he's so off. The barrel of acid scene is just remarkable. I saw it in a theater. It shocked the audience. And shocked me. I had this strange urge to rewind, even though I was sitting in a chair in a theater. Like, the urge to re-see that scene immediately after it happened was so strong. I felt like my hand pulse, like I was reaching for a remote. It was so compelling. Just really cool. And then the scariest thing is his relentlessness. I mean, there's a section of 10 Cloverfield Lane where he basically has won. He basically has beaten down his two captives so efficiently and brutally that they kind of give in to being this fake ass family. And they're like sitting around playing board games and doing puzzles. And if they hadn't stumbled on new information, you almost could have seen that situation lasting that way for a long time. Like, he had beaten the life and soul and resistance out of them. And any movie where characters sitting around playing Monopoly is the most soul-crushing moment of the movie, that is a magic trick and truly special. Okay, last one before the main event is The Man, Herc Harvey, Carnival of Souls. Now, I can count on one hand the number of horror movies where an iconic horror villain is played by the actual director of the movie itself. And that's what I meant when I said we were looking for special things. That almost never happens. And it's not the performance in this case, right? Because he does some great things physically with the character of the man who's basically like a representative of death. He's like death's right-hand person who is trying to drag Candace Hillegloss back into the realization that she's dead, or into afterlife or non-afterlife or whatever comes next. But Herc Harvey as a director, and this was his only feature film, mind-blowing, that he just came out from the documentary, instructional, educational film background, made a horror masterpiece that will live forever, and then just went back to doing what he did. That was it, just like an explosion of genius. But Herc Harvey had such a good eye that he knew exactly how to frame this character, how to make him move slow and then fast, how to bring him out of a background. It makes me wonder what Michael Myers would have been like if John Carpenter had played him himself. Like, would that make it different? Like, does that knowledge of the visuals inform how the character moves? But the man in this movie is just death. So he's unavoidable. You cannot win. And you can't go any extended amount of time in the movie without seeing him or one of his minions or representatives. And it's hard to read why he's so gleeful about it, right? Like, why he's, it doesn't feel quite sadistic. It would be different. That's the typical horror villain, right? Like the twist of the knife or the causing extra pain or Jason pushing your face into like some liquid nitrogen. Like, there's that extra layer of cruelty. He's not harming Candace in this movie. He's shepherding, he's like herding her into the realization that she's dead. But he's got this fixed smile on his face, like a rictus grin the whole time, that it's not, you can't quite read it like he's enjoying what he's doing. The way I read it is, I know this great joke. I know this thing that you don't know, which is, everyone runs from me and you all end up with me. I think this was the movie that terrified me most as a child out of all the black and white horror movies I ever saw. And I watched a lot of them. I love the classics. This one really got under my skin, and it got under a lot of people's skin apparently, because it's a super influential movie. Imagine only directing one film and influencing David Lynch, who talked about how heavily this movie influenced him when he made Eraserhead, and influencing George Romero, who made Night of the Living Dead, I don't know, like 5 or 6 years after Carnival of Souls, and listed it as a major influence on Night of the Living Dead. I mean, Herc Harvey not only gave a huge inspirational push to two of the greatest modern directors of all time, but he played an iconic horror villain that's unforgettable. Just a really remarkable achievement. Okay, listeners, I'm going to gush and probably ramble here. I apologize in advance. But out of all this embarrassment of riches that we just talked about, how could none of them be my number one choice for most underrated horror villain of all time? And the reason is, I think the one I'm about to talk about pulls off one of the greatest magic tricks in the history of movies. I'm not horror movies, movies. My number one choice is Johnny Favorite from Angel Heart, a 1987 horror noir directed by Alan Parker, who directed the hell out of this movie. No pun intended. And if you've seen Angel Heart, you heard me right. I didn't say Louis Cipher was my choice for number one horror villain of all time. I said Johnny Favorite, played by Mickey Rourke, sort of. So I don't want to walk through the whole plot of Angel Heart here. If you haven't seen it, please, please turn this off and go watch it. And then please come back. But The trick that I had mentioned earlier, or the special thing that I mentioned earlier about having dual villains, that's just part of the secret sauce of what makes this so amazing. But now that, if you have seen Angel Heart, or now that you've gone and seen it and come back, I just want to talk to you as someone who's seen this movie. Think about Louis Cipher. Think about this character. So what does he do in the movie? Not what he represents, the devil, but what does he do? He eats an egg, right? Like, he does nothing. He literally, there is no action that he takes. He lurks and he has conversations and that's it. And I get that he's the devil, but that's basically just the behavior of my, like, overly nosy neighbor lurking and having conversations. Almost all the awful, and there are truly awful things that happen in Angel Heart. All the awful things that happen here are done by Mickey Rourke. And Mickey Rourke is basically, his character is named Harry Angel. He's a private detective who's being sent on a search for himself. And he's going around, like, putting the pieces together of Johnny Favorite's past, because that's who he's looking for, himself. But Johnny Favorite set all of this horror show into motion when he made a deal with the devil and then tried to get out of that deal by cutting someone else's heart out and eating it while it was still beating, stealing their soul, and trying to hide in their identity to fool the devil so the devil couldn't collect on the contract. And the deaths of all the subsequent characters, Kruzmark and Toot Sweet and Epiphany, and there's so many, they're all at the hands of Harry Angel / Johnny Favorite. But Johnny Favorite is the one doing it. Harry Angel actually says at some point in the movie, when Robert De Niro asks him, do you have any fix on Johnny Favorite? He's like, I don't know where he is, but I know he's running around killing everyone I talk to. And there are ways that characters die in this movie that I don't even think I'm allowed to say on this podcast. Like, I'm afraid the episode would get banned. It's so bad. And some of what's intimated about what happens behind the scenes or off screen is even worse. But the slashings and the boilings and the flayings and the way Epiphany dies, which I can't even say, these things happen at the hands of the true villain of the movie. Now, let's dive into Johnny Favorite just real quick. There's a moment where we're being told that the Evangeline, who is the mother of Epiphany, played by Lisa Bonet, Evangeline is one of Johnny Favorite's potential wives. It's one of his women that he's dating. And by the way, later on, Johnny Favorite, in the guise of Harry Angel, has sex with Epiphany, which is his daughter. So not only does he abandon the girlfriend, the mom, he then has sex with his own daughter. But there's a moment where we're told that Evangeline says, Johnny Favorite is as close to true evil as I would ever want to get. Everyone that knew him back in the day, before he became Harry Angel, said that he was bad luck, that he successfully conjured the devil and other demons multiple times, that he used to carry a human skull around with him and just stare into its eyes. And in the very brief montage where we get to see the actual killings, they're as brutal as you can get. There's a moment where he's slicing someone to death with a straight razor and he's smoking a cigarette in between the slashes, and the look on Mickey Rourke's face in that moment is, I can't even describe it. His reaction to finding another dead body is to light another cigarette by striking a match off the corpse's foot. Johnny is as close to zero fucks as you can get. And because he's sort of a mix between the Harry Angel unaware character and the Johnny Favorite character lurking underneath the surface, it's not full-on villainy all the time. There's actually a really great, subtle, amazing touch when Harry Angel goes to see Kruzmark, the witch, and she offers him some tea. And she says she has three choices. Jasmine, which is green. Darjeeling, which is black. And oolong, which is neither. And he picks oolong. And she gets this really knowing smile on her face. And he doesn't even know why he's choosing it. And that's one of the most chilling things about this character is the Johnny favorite underneath is causing the Harry Angel character to have all these echoes, but he doesn't know why. He fears chickens, but he doesn't know why, even though they were pivotal in rituals and sacrifices that were happening at when he was back as Johnny Favorite. He's desperately trying to avoid being any kind of harmful situation. He tells Louis Cipher earlier in the movie that the closest he comes to death is standing at the intersection and watching the ambulance go by. Like he has a very mediocre private investigative practice because he takes no chances because he's very afraid of everything ending because Johnny Favorite thought he could never end. He thought he could be immortal. He thought he could trick the devil. So there's, and now Harry Angel is here picking oolong because he doesn't want to be good. And he doesn't want to be bad. He's like stuck in between. He's doing all of these things, but he doesn't know why. And the true, true evil at the heart of Johnny Favorite is why the devil has nothing to do but sit back and laugh. He's just going to spin him up against himself. I mean, who better than the devil to know that your biggest enemy is yourself? I mean, he's the one who fell. And this leads me to the other thing that made me choose this. Because of how special and unique the effect of this is imagine what it takes to perform as a villain buried in a hero. There is no doubt in my mind that Mickey Rourke outacted Robert De Niro in this film. He got into an acting duel with De Niro and won. Johnny Favorite, by all accounts, was the most charming person you could ever come across. He was a star. They said he was bigger than Sinatra before Sinatra ever existed. He had tons of fans. He was like a magnet to people. And a lot of our great horror villains have that kind of charm, like Hannibal Lecter, like Captain Spaulding, like Pinhead, strangely, or like almost every incarnation of Dracula. Now imagine playing that charm, but through like coffee filters, right? Like the Harry Angel character in Angel Heart is really charming, but it's muted. And that's because he's a clueless, sort of bumbling guy with this incredibly charismatic horror villain inside. So the charm leaks out in weird ways, but it's never full-on force. And that level of difficulty of playing that right and just nailing it 1,000% like Mickey Rourke did is incredible. So a character that has Pennywise level of charm but buried underneath, one who could give any character from any of the great satanic panic movies like Devil Rides Out or whatever at the time, a character who brings down everyone he touches. A character that's capable of boiling you alive or eating your heart. One who's headed down a path or an elevator straight to hell. And that you're still sort of rooting for is my pick for most underrated horror villain ever. Let us know what you think of our choices or give us some of your own at Horror Weekly on Facebook or at Horror Weekly Pod on Instagram. We're also looking for ideas for future podcast episodes, so if you have any, hit us up with those too. This is a collaborative community podcast. Speaking of, thank you to everybody who voted, commented, helped argue or have a conversation on this topic. And that's it for us. Until next Wednesday, have a great horror week.